Audrey Grote hadn't had an easy life, but she worked hard to make the best one she could. A single mother with six daughters, she faced her share of struggles, but she was never the type to give in. Whether she was working two jobs or struggling to find one, she did whatever it took to put food on the table and keep a roof over their heads. She was their rock, the one person who would go to the ends of the earth for them. And then she was gone. While no one knew for sure what Audrey was capable of, the one thing they could be certain of was that she'd never abandon her children. They were her life. When she failed to come home from an afternoon outing, everyone knew something had gone terribly wrong. The search began that first day and has lurched on for nearly three decades. How does someone just vanish into thin air? They don't. Someone takes them away. And just like at the end of every horror movie, there's a monster that needs to be confronted. Police quickly closed in on the most likely suspect, a friend and former coworker who was the last person to see her alive. In their hunt for Audrey and her fate, he was their most vital witness. But when they discovered a dark secret he'd been harboring, investigators began to wonder if Audrey had actually fallen victim to a random abductor, or if some secrets are worth killing for. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 156, The Disappearance of Audrey Grote. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine one of the most notorious unsolved missing persons cases in Vermont history. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions through the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. One sunny summer afternoon, Audrey Grote left her home and never returned. Nearly three decades later, the mystery of her disappearance continues to haunt the investigators who searched for her and the children she left behind. This is Episode 156, The Disappearance of Audrey Grote. Route 12 slowly winds and twists its way north, crisscrossing and trading places with the curves of the Dog River as it flows towards the Winooski River, the waters meeting beneath the concrete pillars of Interstate 89. The rail line runs parallel, just off the road to the west, its rusted rails peeking through the tall grass and changing tree line like dull orange beams against the lush greenery. Dog River Road breaks off from 12, arching its way around the half-clover interchange of 89, before rolling east to ride along the edge of a large, triangular plot of land thick with evergreens, but for one small chunk of cleared earth, a graying slice of pavement in the shadow of the trees. Normally, dozens of cars and trucks are wedged into the space between painted white lines at the park and go, a spot where people can get together to carpool or hop on a bus, leaving their vehicles behind without the cost of a more centrally located lot. However, spaces are typically abundant on Sundays when the work week commuters are clinging to the final hours of their weekend before the dreaded arrival of the Monday morning sun and the beginning of another hectic and busy week. Unlike so many other mornings, however, this day the hunt was not for an empty space, but one which might already be occupied. A cruiser from the Northfield Police Department slowly entered the lot, rolling quietly through. It didn't take long to find the red and silver truck that shouldn't still be there. It was parked in a space where the asphalt meets the grass, no outward indication of trouble other than the fact that it hadn't moved in nearly 24 hours. Walking slowly around the truck, The officer didn't see anything that would be cause for alarm. The doors were locked, the windows rolled up and intact. The pavement around the vehicle was clear, nothing to suggest there'd been any issues in the lot the previous night. Glancing through the windows, the interior was neat, no signs of disarray, no signs that anyone had even been inside the truck, except for one detail. The keys, plugged into the ignition and dangling, as though someone had accidentally locked them inside, or perhaps been interrupted by something or someone before the engine could turn over. As the officer reached for his radio, a light breeze swept in from the south, the trees swaying with the whisper of a rustle. Normally, the serene calm would be a welcome pause to take a breath, but on this morning there was something else in the wind, a feeling of unease beyond explanation that fell over the lot, and he could feel it. Staring back towards the truck, the officer reported its location, and while that was one question answered, there were a slew of others which were far more concerning. Most of all, if her truck was here, where exactly was Audrey? At the time, no one had any way of knowing that that question would slowly transform into one of the biggest and longest enduring mysteries in Vermont history, one for which the answer still remains unknown. Audrey Gale Grote was born on Tuesday, June 10, 1952, in Middlesex, Connecticut, to parents Carl and Laura. Audrey was the second born in her family, having an older sister, and over the course of the next decade and a half, she'd go on to welcome three more sisters and two brothers. The soft-spoken child with bright eyes and dark hair easily endeared herself to those around her, and her laugh is said to have been infectious. Audrey grew up in a blue-collar home. Her father worked for Shoreline Wash Sand, a commercial sand plant, and was a member of the Teamsters Union. Growing up, Audrey displayed her strong will and indomitable personality early on. Outspoken and direct, Audrey acquired a reputation for being the type to speak her mind without holding back. One friend later said he never saw Audrey back down, and described her personality as being both silk and sandpaper. During her childhood, she grew up in the family home on Green Hill Road in Killingworth, a small town in Middlesex County which, at the time, had less than 1,000 residents. Not a great deal of information is available about Audrey's youth, and while records regarding her siblings and parents are readily available, she always seems to fall into a gap where the records haven't been digitized or have been lost to time. The first time she shows up in the public record, outside of her birth announcement, is in the spring of 1972 in Barry, Vermont, 200 miles to the north of her hometown. On Friday, June 9th, the day before her 20th birthday, Audrey was married to James Victor Coate. According to their marriage license, the couple were married by the city clerk and at the time were living together in an apartment on West Street. Less than a year later, in April of 1973, Audrey gave birth to her first child, a baby girl. At the time, the young couple was living in an apartment on Elm Street in Montpelier. James was self-employed, working as a painter, and frequently advertising his services in the local papers. Life wasn't exactly easy, but Audrey was determined to make things work. Again, she was never the type to give in or allow the pressure to keep her down. And whether she had to work one job or three, she always found a way to contribute to the household and provide for her family. Over the course of the next 10 years, that family would continue to grow as she'd give birth to five more children, all daughters. During the summer of 1974, Audrey's parents made the decision to separate, and 2 years later, their divorce was finalized in January of 76. This didn't exactly come as a surprise to the family, but for Audrey, it may have hit close to home, as her own marriage was beginning to hit the rocks. As the 70s transitioned into the 80s, it seemed apparent, Audrey and James weren't going to find a way to make this work. In 1983, while the couple was preparing to separate, Audrey sustained a heavy blow when her father passed away at the age of 57. He had been sick for a long time, and in the end he lost the fight and was laid to rest in Evergreen Cemetery in Killingworth, just a few miles from the Green Hill Road home. After Audrey and James went their separate ways, she took primary custody of their six daughters. While being a single mom to one child can be challenging at best, Audrey was determined to keep the girls with her. It would be a struggle, and sometimes it seemed like she wasn't going to be able to make it work. But again, there was no challenge she could face that would make her back down. 2 days after Christmas that year, the divorce was finalized, and over the next few years, James would move around quite a bit before eventually settling in Jamestown in the western corner of upstate New York. Over the next few years, Audrey worked several different jobs to support the family, oftentimes holding down two full-time careers while trying to balance raising the girls. In the late 80s, Audrey and the girls were living in the South Reigate area in the east of the state near the border of New Hampshire. In 1990, the family moved from Reigate to Northfield, where they rented a small apartment. With the changing of the decade, Audrey had been putting together a plan and decided it was time to ask the kids what they thought about it. She sat down with the girls and pitched them an idea. Rather than moving through apartments and never having a locked-in location to call home, she asked how they'd feel about purchasing land and building a house together. The kids were more than excited by the opportunity and agreed. Not long after, the family found themselves putting a house together on attractive land off rural Hallstrom Road. They worked together throughout the summer and moved into the work-in-progress home in the fall. When speaking to the Rutland Daily Herald, Audrey's daughter Amanda explained, quote, "Mom and us girls built it. It didn't have running water, and for 8 months we didn't have electricity. We had one bedroom and a loft, and everything else was wide open. It was pretty cool." End quote. No matter what was going on, Audrey found the time and ability to be a part of her daughter's lives. She never missed a soccer game and instead would be one of the loudest voices on the sideline. She turned up for school events. Whatever the girls needed at the time, she'd be there. When things grew difficult, she'd face down the challenge without a moment's hesitance. Her daughter, Lorena, later told the story of how she wore hearing aids in both ears, and as a result, her school thought she might be better suited going to a school that specialized in working with the hearing impaired, but she just wanted to go to a normal school in a normal place, and Audrey stood by her. She saw no reason to send her away from the teachers and friends she'd known for so long, and in the end, Audrey's insistence won out. Lorena has said she'll never forget how, no matter what, their mother always had their backs. In 1992, Audrey, now 40 years old, picked up work in a warehouse for Community Products in Montpelier. It was here that she would meet and befriend 35-year-old Patrick Jarvis. A co-worker, Jarvis had only recently returned to Vermont, having spent some time in South Carolina, where he'd been married, though he was separated from his wife, and their divorce would finalize in February of 93. Throughout the fall and winter of 92, Jarvis and Audrey became close, and according to him, he spent a lot of time around her and the kids. Jarvis later stated that he would often take Audrey and the girls camping and boating in the area of the Wrightsville Reservoir. Beyond just hanging out and working together, Jarvis later told investigators that he'd spent a decent amount of time at the home Audrey was working on. According to his statements, he assisted in putting up sheetrock and installing a shower. It seemed that everything was going well, though the true nature of their relationship remained somewhat mysterious. While some reports define Jarvis as Audrey's boyfriend, others simply refer to him as a friend or family friend with no romantic involvement. This may have been, in part, due to the ambiguity between the two, who clearly didn't have any major commitment, but were spending a lot of time together. In 1993, things took a turn for the worse when Audrey was laid off from her job at the warehouse. While she tried her best to maintain financial stability for her five girls, her oldest was 21 at the time and had moved into her own place, the challenge truly put her through her paces. She ultimately had to seek out assistance as the layoff had hit her harder than she'd expected. Friends and neighbors who had come to know Audrey in the years since she had been putting the house together told reporters that she wasn't the type to ask for help, but when it became a matter of providing for her girls, that's what they needed. When the truck didn't work, she'd ride a bike to get to work or to the store. She never asked for loans, never wanted to depend on anyone but herself to reap the benefits of her own hard work. But in that trying time, she swallowed her pride and began receiving government assistance in the spring. It wasn't a permanent solution by any means, not as far as Audrey was concerned, but it was there to help out while she tried to find a better job. Jarvis sustained a back injury around this time and was out of work for a few months, with plans on returning towards the end of the summer, in August. That same month, Audrey would mysteriously vanish. The morning of Saturday, August 21st, began as most weekends usually did. Audrey did some work around the property. She was in the process of assembling a stone wall and trying to get the landscape under control. She loved being in the outdoors and spent a great deal of time carrying out tasks around the property, kicking off her shoes to feel the warmth of the grass and earth. This day, though, she'd made plans for the afternoon, though whether those plans were for a fun outing or a difficult confrontation remains the source of much debate. What we do know is she was going to be seeing Jarvis that day, and this led to an argument between the mother and one of her daughters, Karina. According to the Rutland Daily Herald, Karina wanted to go along with Audrey that afternoon, but her mother wasn't having it. When she was told she couldn't go, there was protesting and a bit of back and forth, but Audrey had made up her mind, and once that was done, no one was going to change it. In frustration, Karina, 13 at the time, demanded that she be back by 6:30 p.m., and Audrey, with a bit of a smirk, accepted the terms of their arrangement, telling the child she'd see her in a few hours. Karina, still a bit frustrated, dramatically explained that if she wasn't back by then, she'd be calling the police to report her missing. In a bitter twist of fate, Audrey wouldn't make it back, and within 24 hours, the 41-year-old single mother of six would be reported missing. Audrey left the home that afternoon to bring one of her daughters over to a friend's house in nearby Middlesex, where she'd be spending the night. This will become the last officially confirmed sighting of Audrey. According to multiple sources, when Audrey arrived that day, she was driven by Patrick Jarvis in his beige two-door Ford Escort. Audrey hugged her daughter, told her to be good, and confirmed that she'd be back by the next morning to pick her up. Reportedly, Audrey and Jarvis drove off together, and what exactly occurred over the course of the next 8 hours has never been definitively proven one way or the other. Sitting at home that night, Karina watched as the clock approached, met, and passed 6:30, the time her mother had said she'd be back by. The child didn't call the police, though, as at first, it didn't seem like a big deal. Yes, she was running late, but she'd normally call if she were going to be extremely late. However, if she was driving on her way back to the house, there'd be no reason for her to stop at a payphone and make that call. Unfortunately, the clock kept moving, and by 10 p.m., Karina couldn't hold out any longer. She picked up the phone and dialed the number for Jarvis's apartment, where she spoke to his roommate, who explained that neither he nor Audrey were there, and he didn't know where they were. Over the course of the next hour, Karina called back several times, but always received the same answer. 3 hours later, at 1 a.m. on Sunday, August 22nd, Karina made another call and yet again was told Audrey wasn't there. By this time, the roommate was getting noticeably annoyed by the frequent calls and told the teen that her mother was fine and she'd call soon. When no call had come in by 7 a.m., Karina called again, and when her initial annoyance at her mother being late was now changing into worry and concern. 20 minutes away in Middlesex, the friends Audrey had left her youngest with were beginning to wonder where she was themselves. It was unlike her to be late without a call or an explanation, and she'd never been late to pick up one of the girls before. Several calls were made between the friends' houses, Audrey's house, and into the homes of neighbors and acquaintances, but no one had seen Audrey since the previous afternoon. When no one could track down Audrey, they finally made a call to the police, and it was the Northfield Police Department which initially took the case. After sending a unit to the friend's home and then to Audrey's, they were able to establish what her plans had been the previous day. After dropping her truck, a red and silver Chevy S10, at the park and ride off Dog River Road, she'd hop into Jarvis's escort and drop off her daughter. Then the two were supposed to head for University Mall in South Burlington, about an hour's drive to the northwest. After, Audrey would be dropped back at the park and ride where she'd pick up her truck and make the 15-minute drive home. In hopes of determining her possible location, a unit was dispatched to the park and ride and quickly found the truck. While an officer was on his way to the park and ride, there was a general sense that this missing person's situation would likely clear itself up in a matter of hours. Reportedly, the thought at the time was, this was a 41-year-old mother of six, and maybe she decided to take a little time to herself, visit with friends, or spend the night out. Police began trying to determine anywhere Audrey may have chosen to go, contacting friends and family, but with each subsequent call, they crossed another name off the list. Right around the time they were getting down to the last names, they received a report that Audrey's truck had been located. There were no signs of a disturbance, though it was noted that the keys were in the ignition and the doors were locked. At the time, it was considered possible that Audrey had found herself stranded and may have walked off to find a payphone, or gotten lost and confused, or perhaps picked up by the wrong person. Due to a lack of evidence or information to suggest that something sinister had occurred, police couldn't characterize their investigation as criminal yet, but it wasn't exactly normal either. 2 days would pass before investigators went public with their concerns. Throughout the rest of Sunday and Monday, they continued to try and locate Audrey through friends and family. While they may not have felt the urgency from those early moments, her friends and family did, and they quickly began putting missing persons flyers together for distribution. It was this action which seemed to force the hand of the police, who on Tuesday the 24th made a statement to the media. Northfield Police Chief Michael O'Neill later stated, quote, "We're treating it as a mysterious disappearance. Anybody who just vanishes with no note, no reason, no trace, it's mysterious. We really don't have any idea now. It's under investigation, and we're trying to put some answers to this. There's really no indication that she would pack up and take off." End quote. While the flyers had certainly caused investigators to react, there may have been yet another factor at work. On that Tuesday morning, they returned to the park and ride to examine Audrey's truck and to ask around if anyone had seen her since Saturday. During a preliminary sweep of the area, they found Audrey's purse tucked into some bushes along the edge of the lot. Now, with her keys locked in the truck and her purse hidden in the brush, the picture began to fill in, and it was decided that they needed to launch a search of that area. The parking lot is butted up against a large wooded lot, and that was the first area they focused on. While nothing was located in that first search, the passage of time, the discovery of the purse, and the absence of any sightings was enough for investigators to realize they were dealing with something much bigger than a general missing persons case. A call was made to the Vermont State Police to request their assistance with the investigation, as Northfield had a very small department and not enough detectives to dedicate them to Audrey's case for long. On Wednesday, August 25th, the state police impounded Audrey's truck and brought it to their barracks in Middlesex so they could examine the vehicle for evidence. They also began plans for a second search of the surrounding area of the park and ride, which would take place the next day, though it would yield the same results. No sign of Audrey, no sign of anything. By Friday, August 27th, the likely outcome of the situation was becoming increasingly grim, and the state police organized a larger search party. 25 police officers, along with local volunteers, spent 3 hours going over every inch of the woods near the lot. When that search was completed, and again showed no evidence that Audrey had been in the woods, the focus of the investigation turned towards people in Audrey's life. While the Northfield police had interviewed some people throughout the week, Chief O'Neill explained that they would be re-interviewing in hopes that someone would remember something they'd previously left out. During that time, O'Neill tried to keep things positive, saying they weren't sure what they were dealing with yet. But Captain Kerry Sleeper of the State Police was more direct, as he would tell the Burlington Free Press, quote, "We're hopeful that it's a missing person, but as time goes by, the more concerned we are that something else may have happened. I'm very hopeful for her and her family that she calls from someplace and says she just needed time away, but we also have to prepare for other circumstances. That's what we're doing now." End quote. The idea that Audrey could have decided randomly to just go off unannounced for a period of time was still being entertained in some police circles, but not by anyone who actually knew her. Tanya, her second eldest daughter, 18 at the time, spoke to reporters on Saturday the 28th and made it quite clear, saying, quote, "My mother would never just leave any of my sisters at home alone and not call. My mother has those days where she just gets up and goes, but she tells us when she's leaving and when she'll be back. When she's an hour late, she'll call." End quote. In hopes of determining where exactly her mother had last been seen, Tanya placed a call to Patrick Jarvis, and according to her report, he claimed to have dropped her off at the truck at approximately 10 p.m. Saturday night and hadn't seen her since. This began to give rise to the possibility that Audrey may have been attacked in the lot and possibly abducted from that spot, with the suspect tossing her purse into the bushes during the struggle. Since the beginning, Audrey's disappearance had been the primary focus, but there was another issue slowly brewing behind the scenes. Without her there, who was going to look after the younger girls? At the time, Tanya stepped in and began trying to keep things going, taking on the role of surrogate mother to her four sisters. When speaking to the Burlington Free Press, she explained the gravity of that situation, saying, quote, "I found out about this disappearance Monday, and it was just like 10,000 pounds on my shoulders. It's called growing up real fast." End quote. One person police were highly interested in speaking with was Patrick Jarvis, the last person who had seen Audrey the night she disappeared. In their first conversation with the 36-year-old, he laid out the night's events fairly plainly. According to his account, he and Audrey had gone to the mall in South Burlington for a few hours before returning to the Montpelier area. He then claimed that he and Audrey traveled to a remote spot in the Middlesex area where he'd had a tent set up. Jarvis said the two drank beer, had sex, and then he drove her back to her truck. Initially, he told police that he'd pulled into the park and ride sometime between 9:45 and 10 p.m., watched as Audrey unlocked and got into her truck, starting the engine. Once he felt she was secure, he waved and turned out of the lot, heading towards his place at the Highgate Apartments, less than 10 miles away. He told police that he arrived home between 10 and 10:15. Investigators later found a witness who could confirm seeing him at the complex around that time. However, he wasn't yet in for the night. Jarvis went on to tell police that after arriving home, he took a shower and went back out. He claimed he was supposed to meet a friend in Burlington, but when that fell through, he just began driving around the city looking for a woman to pick up. When he struck out there, he headed out of town going north to the Lamoille River fishing access area near Lake Champlain. Jarvis claimed he was there fishing until just after sunrise on Sunday, at which time he headed back towards his apartment. Police apparently found Jarvis's description of events that night highly suspicious. As they were investigating Audrey's disappearance, they stumbled upon something else, something disturbing. Believing there might be a connection between Audrey's disappearance and what they had found, police obtained a warrant and wiretapped Jarvis's phone. The tap went into place on Tuesday, August 31st, 10 days after Audrey was last seen, and just one day after the Northfield Police turned the case over to the Vermont State Police, who were far better equipped to handle it, though Northfield would stay involved. It didn't take long for investigators to hear enough, and within 24 hours they obtained a warrant for Jarvis's arrest, not for any connection to Audrey's disappearance, but for a crime equally disturbing, if not dramatically more sickening. On the morning of Wednesday, September 1st, police initiated surveillance on Jarvis's apartment. That afternoon, he stepped outside, got into his car, and started heading to work. As he traveled down Barry Montpelier Road, he was pulled over and asked to step out of the car, at which time he was placed under arrest. He was officially charged with aggravated sexual assault of a juvenile, and his vehicle was impounded. The charges stem from statements given by a young relative of Audrey's, who told police that Jarvis had sexually assaulted her on 6 separate occasions in August. The victim described Jarvis as a family friend who had, on several occasions, paid her $5 in exchange for cleaning his apartment. However, at some point, this became an excuse to get her alone where he could assault her. Sworn affidavits later showed that he had picked the victim up on Sunday the 22nd, the day Audrey was reported missing, and assaulted her again. In fact, when police arrived to question him on the morning of the 23rd, they found the victim in the apartment, which kicked off their investigation into his activities. The same day Jarvis was arrested, state police began conducting searches of the Lamoille River in the area near where he claimed to have gone fishing the night Audrey disappeared. The search didn't turn up any results, but it's interesting to note that police were utilizing boats with cadaver dogs on them at that location. When asked about the arrest of Jarvis, the river search, and whether or not he was a suspect in the disappearance, Sergeant Ross of the state police told the Daily Herald, quote, "I would stop short of calling him a suspect, but I would say we're very interested in where he's been and what he's been doing," end quote. Another search was conducted using cadaver dogs at the same time, this one in a remote area of Middlesex. This was later noted as being the location where Jarvis had told police that he and Audrey had spent time at a campsite in his tent. It became quite clear that police were taking a hard look at Jarvis and breaking down everything he had told them about that night. When investigating Jarvis's statements about the night he was with Audrey, police traveled to University Mall and started showing photos to store employees, mall security, and other people who would have been there that day. They weren't able to find a single witness who could confirm having seen Audrey that night. In fact, after Audrey dropped off her daughter that afternoon, they couldn't find a single witness who had seen her anywhere. After his arrest, investigators began questioning Audrey's friends and family about the man and what knowledge they or Audrey may have had about his past, most specifically, his criminal record. That record had quite a few notes on it and dated back to 1973 in Vermont, with arrests for trespassing, reckless endangerment, possession, and an assault charge from December of 92. However, it was his out-of-state record in South Carolina that really caught their attention. In 1990, Jarvis pled guilty to a charge of conducting lewd and lascivious acts with a minor under the age of 14, and received a suspended sentence and probation. However, after returning to Vermont, he was sent back to South Carolina for a probation violation and ended up serving approximately 30 months. Several friends, when speaking to the Burlington Free Press, explained that they didn't think Audrey was aware of his past, but police files would later show that at least her eldest daughter, Angela, believed she did know. Beyond that, sworn affidavits showed that Audrey was not only aware, but that she had directly told her daughters that they were never to be alone with Jarvis. She apparently didn't explain why, with one document claiming that when asked, she didn't want to go into the details and instead reiterated her warning. Following the arrest, police stated that Jarvis had been cooperative until they began to question him more intensely about Audrey and brought up the possibility of a polygraph test. At that time, Jarvis stopped speaking to police and requested legal counsel. This concerned investigators as, with Jarvis facing the aggravated sexual assault of a juvenile charge, it would now limit their ability to question him further about Audrey and the night of August 21st. At that time, Jarvis left the matter with the story he'd originally given, that they'd gone to the mall, gone to the tent, and then he'd dropped her off. Without an ability to get more information directly from him, a second search of the Lamoille River was conducted, this time involving the state, Northfield, and Montpelier police, along with the Washington County Sheriff's Department. Again, nothing was found, but police were looking at every location Jarvis had claimed to have gone that night. On Thursday, September 2nd, he was arraigned and pled not guilty. Considering his past arrest and the weight of the charges against him, which could hold a sentence of up to life, the judge considered him to be a flight risk, and bail was set at $25,000. Interestingly, during the arraignment, Washington County State's Attorney Terry Trono made direct reference to Jarvis having possibly been involved in the disappearance, saying, quote, "I don't think it's any secret, Your Honor, that Mr. Jarvis is a suspect," end quote. Following the hearing, Jarvis was remanded to the Northeast Correctional Facility in St. Johnsbury to await trial. While the wheels were moving in regard to Jarvis's arrest, Audrey's family was growing frustrated with the lack of communication between investigators and them. 2 weeks would pass, and the family was left in the dark. Angela, along with Audrey's mother, Laura, stood firm in saying that they hadn't been updated about anything and wanted to know what was being done in regard to the missing woman. Laura, 67 at the time, drove up from Connecticut because she couldn't get anyone on the phone who could provide her with an update, if she could get anyone to call her back in the first place. The state police spokesman said that he'd look into the matter, but out of the eyes of the public, investigators had several different searches going. One was at Jarvis's apartment, and the other was at his mother's home in Middlesex. Police wouldn't say what they were looking for, but the Bennington Banner reported that a state police crime lab van was at the home on Thursday, September 16th. Investigators later noted they had seen freshly overturned earth on the mother's property and wanted to look into that. As police were kicking over every rock they could in relation to Jarvis, Audrey's daughters were facing a difficult situation. Tanya had originally intended to take guardianship of her sisters, but she withdrew that request when two local families offered to help out. One of them sought guardianship of one of the girls, while the other was willing to take in two. The judge would need to review all of the information before making a ruling and requested a signed form of consent from their biological father living in New York. In late September, the Burlington Free Press obtained several police documents related to the disappearance. One affidavit, written by an officer but noted as being the statements of one of Audrey's children, said that on the day after Audrey vanished, she had accompanied Jarvis to the campsite he previously mentioned to investigators. The statement reads in part, quote, "Before they left the site, the girl said Jarvis removed a shovel from an adjacent cellar hole and put it in the back of his car," end quote. This statement is credited with being the impetus behind investigators searching the campsite and surrounding woods weeks earlier. The Rutland Daily Herald reported on the 25th that police had executed a search warrant on Jarvis's apartment in early September, and during that search had removed several items related to the sexual assault. Among those items were bedsheets, body lotion, and men's cologne. Reportedly, after this search, on September 11th, investigators received information from an anonymous source claiming that Jarvis's roommate and several other people were cleaning out his bedroom, so a second search was executed. This time, police took into their possession a green sleeping bag and what has only ambiguously been described as poetry. There was also something else taken, though it's never been revealed exactly what, and police have only referred to it as, quote, "evidence to suggest a motive." Nearly a month later, on Tuesday, October 19th, a district court judge was forced to reduce the charges against Jarvis. According to the Daily Herald, Jarvis had been charged with aggravated sexual assault based in part on his prior conviction in South Carolina. However, this could only be applied if the suspect had previously been charged with sexual assault on a minor, but Jarvis had taken a plea of lewd and lascivious behavior, a lesser charge, and so they no longer had legal standing for aggravated sexual assault. Instead, Jarvis was arraigned on 4 counts of sexual assault against a minor under the age of 15. As a result, his bail was reduced from $25,000 to $5,000. State's attorney Trono tried to argue against this, but he was unable to produce enough to maintain the original charge. While all of this was happening, little progress was being made in the search for Audrey. Captain O'Neill, when asked, explained, quote, "It's a waiting game right now. We're just rehashing what we've already hashed over," end quote. He went on to say that with hunting season coming up the next month, there was a chance someone might discover evidence in a remote location. In early November, investigators announced that they would be conducting a search of the Wrightsville Dam and Reservoir area in Middlesex on Saturday the 6th. This location has a swimming area and boat launch, was mentioned by Jarvis as a place he used to take Audrey and the kids, and is less than 2 miles from the location where he claims he and Audrey went to a tent the night she was last seen. According to the Free Press, New England Canine Search and Rescue Squad was brought in to search the reservoir and surrounding area. Several cadaver dogs indicated the scent of human decomposition near the southern part of the reservoir. Police then made plans to bring in divers to search beneath the water in that particular area. The reservoir itself was noted as being over top of submerged farmland and 30 feet deep at its deepest point. They were eager to get the search done as the weather was beginning to change, and the next few months would make land searches much more challenging and water searches nearly impossible. Reportedly, they had received a tip that Audrey's body could be found in a large body of water in the Middlesex area. On Tuesday, November 9th, 8 divers entered the 40-degree water in pairs of 2. The search was difficult, to say the least, with police stating that just 20 feet beneath the surface, the visibility was down to 3 feet, and beyond 27 feet, there was zero visibility, and the search had to be conducted by feel, with divers attached to ropes connected to boats on the surface that would help guide them along. Divers were in the water from 10:30 a.m. to 4 p.m., but didn't recover any evidence connected to Audrey. Police were frustrated, but they made it clear they knew it would be a difficult search, and their failure to find something didn't mean she couldn't be there. Over the course of the next month, they received several reports from visitors to the reservoir who all claimed to have picked up a foul stench near the area that had been searched. In early December, guardianship for Audrey's daughters was finally decided. A local soccer coach and his family took in her youngest girl, while Audrey's friend and mechanic, Jim Lambert, and his wife, Judy, took in 2 of the other girls. A 4th girl, who was noted as living with a family in Middlesex at the time, decided to leave Vermont and moved into her estranged father's home in New York. Unfortunately, due to Audrey's disappearance, her children weren't able to receive any Social Security benefits, as there was no proof that she was dead. In addition to that, since they'd been taken in by non-blood relatives, they weren't eligible for financial assistance from the government either. The only way to get them some help would be to allow them to become wards of the state, and none of the children nor the families who had taken them in were willing to do that. On Tuesday, December 7th, Patrick Jarvis agreed to a plea deal with prosecutors. The deal would require him to submit to a polygraph test, though the terms explicitly stated that neither he nor the state could reveal the results. The deal was noted as being made in part due to the victim's unwillingness to testify and psychiatric evaluations saying that she could experience additional trauma by having to do so. In exchange, Jarvis pled guilty to a single charge of lewd and lascivious conduct with a child and received a sentence of 1 to 5 years, with 3 years suspended. Considering he'd been in jail since September, that time would count towards his sentence, and he could be released in as little as 14 months. He'd go on to be on probation after that sentence, couldn't be near anyone under the age of 16, and would be required to undergo counseling. As part of the deal, the judge required Jarvis to allocute, and he admitted that he had performed sexual acts on the child in his apartment. Jarvis did go on to take the polygraph over the course of 3 hours that week, though obviously we don't know the results. 1993 came to an end, with Jarvis in jail and Audrey still missing, with searches on hold due to weather and a lack of new tips and leads. In February of 1994, Gary and Judy Lambert hired Barrie-based lawyer Gary McQuestion and a private investigator to find proof that Audrey was dead so that her children could qualify for her death benefits. By Vermont law, without proof, they would have to wait 7 years. This caused a bit of a rift for police, who worried McQuestion might compromise their investigation, though McQuestion made it clear he would be directing all leads he received related to what might have happened to Audrey to the authorities. 3 months later, on Saturday, May 7th, as the area was thawing out, state police flew over the Wrightsville Dam and announced they were planning new searches. In July, investigators received a call from a man who had discovered a chunk of human hair while fishing in the Marshfield Pond, also known as the Turtlehead Pond, 30 miles to the northeast of Northfield. Police went down to the pond to investigate, though they said they found nothing that connected to Audrey. They did take the hair in for testing, though little was learned from it. However, the man who had called in the tip felt police hadn't looked thoroughly enough and began working to drag the pond himself. The next month, police returned and conducted a more thorough search, though again, found nothing linking that location to Audrey. Somewhere around this time, there's no specific date listed, they also searched a junkyard in the Middlesex area using cadaver dogs, though no evidence was discovered at that time. There hadn't been much in terms of updates regarding the investigation into Audrey's disappearance since the previous fall. Police said that they had retained a forensic anthropologist who specialized in locating burial sites to assist with searches, and when asked about the case itself, investigators told the Daily Herald that they didn't believe Audrey had ever been dropped off at her truck the night she disappeared, and frankly, they didn't believe she'd been to the mall either. They theorized that Audrey had become aware of Jarvis's sexual assault against the child and planned to confront him, and that likely led to her disappearance. When asked if Jarvis was still a suspect, State Police Sergeant Gloria Danforth, the lead on the case, replied, quote, "I will never say he's the only suspect, but he's certainly not ruled out in my book," end quote. By the end of 1994, however, no progress had been made in the investigation, and Audrey's friends and family were becoming concerned that the more time passed, the more likely people were to forget and move on, while they simply could not. The grief and horror they experienced on a daily basis was only amplified when on Tuesday, December 20th, Patrick Jarvis was released from prison after serving just 15 months. He'd be on probation for the next 3 years, and according to investigators, had not agreed to speak with them since the polygraph test a year earlier. Discussing his release with the Burlington Free Press, State Police Lieutenant William O'Leary explained, quote, "We haven't gotten the lucky break we need in big cases. Certainly everybody connected with the case shares a certain degree of frustration. We have to follow due process. If we had enough evidence to arrest him, we would have," end quote. 4 months later, in April of 1995, the Rutland Daily Herald did a feature story on Audrey's disappearance, speaking with several investigators on the case, as well as Audrey's daughters, the Lamberts, and Gary McQuestion. Several new details about the night Audrey vanished, as well as subsequent searches for her, were revealed during these interviews. In regard to that August 9th in 1993, police reported that Jarvis's statements had not been consistent and details had changed each time he was questioned. Jarvis apparently told investigators that he and Audrey traveled to the mall, a distance of approximately 40 miles. After leaving, they stopped at a Wendy's fast food restaurant, and it was noted that while he could clearly remember ordering chili with cheese and crackers, he couldn't remember exactly what roads he had traveled or on what route he had taken that night. After Wendy's, Jarvis claimed to have returned another 40 miles to the Montpelier area, at which time he stopped at a grocery store to pick up a 12-pack of beer and cigarettes. At that time, He and Audrey traveled 7 miles to Middlesex, to a location near Baldock Road, where he'd set up a tent. Jarvis claims he and Audrey drank 6 beers apiece and then had sex before heading towards the park and ride, where he dropped her off between 9:30 and 10 p.m. He claims he watched her get into her truck and start the engine before driving off. However, when questioned a different time, he claimed that he returned to the park and ride 30 minutes after dropping her off and saw her still sitting there inside of her truck. There's also a third change, this time with Jarvis saying in one breath that he offered to drive her home, which she declined, but then also claiming that she told him she might have to call someone to bum a ride, though he had apparently had no explanation for why she'd need a ride if her truck started, or why she wouldn't have just allowed him to take her home under those circumstances. One of Audrey's daughters, in a sworn statement, told police that she directly asked Jarvis where her mother was, and he replied that she, quote, must have walked to a telephone to call some guy and disappeared into thin air, end quote. After driving approximately 100 miles and downing 6 beers, Jarvis then claimed he went home and showered before driving 40 miles back to Burlington. After driving around looking for women, he drove an additional 20 miles to Milton, where he fished until sunrise before driving 60 miles home in the morning. Police had several issues with his story, saying they had no belief that Audrey had been to the mall that night, nor that she had gone to Wendy's. Investigators did say that they found a receipt in Jarvis's apartment showing that he'd made a purchase at the mall that night, but it wasn't time-stamped, and it's theorized he may have actually done this earlier in the day to create an alibi. In a sick twist, the item purchased was reported as being strawberry-flavored motion lotion, which is meant to enhance sexual pleasure. Investigators stated that this lotion was then used to sexually assault his young victim. In addition to that, while they didn't give any details, they stated it was their belief that Jarvis spent approximately 2 hours at the campsite near Baldock Road that night. When speaking to friends and family, they took issue with several of Jarvis's statements. Firstly, friends told police that Audrey had explicitly stated that while she hung out with Jarvis, she didn't have a sexual relationship with him, nor was she interested in one. Beyond that, she wasn't much of a drinker and in fact drank rarely, so the idea of her polishing off 6 beers in the course of a short period of time in a tent seemed a bit unlikely. When asked about the searches, investigators said they had executed nearly a dozen since Audrey had been reported missing and had yet to find any trace of her. When asked if he believed they were getting closer to the truth, Lieutenant O'Leary replied, quote, I don't believe we're in a position to put all of our cards down. There is a solvability factor to this case, and I'm not in any rush to pursue tactics such as that. You don't want to force your hand and come up short. Our theories at this point remain pretty solid. It's just a matter of getting a lucky break. End quote. Since he had been hired, Gary McQuestion had twice submitted evidence into the court to get Audrey officially declared deceased, but had twice been rebuffed for a lack of evidence. In February of 1996, he submitted a massive report with statements from police and family, which all suggested Audrey was gone and wasn't coming back. He pressed on how urgent this was, that her children shouldn't be made to suffer further hardships due to the lack of a body. As part of his hearing, McQuestion had Patrick Jarvis called to the stand to answer questions about the last night the mother of six was seen alive. However, Jarvis would not directly answer even a single question, and instead invoked his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. In light of this hearing, a Superior Court judge ruled 6 months later in September, ordering the state's chief medical examiner to issue a death certificate for Audrey Grote. The death certificate notes Audrey as being presumed dead, listing Saturday, August 21st, 1993, as her date of death. 1 year later, in October of 1997, Audrey's 6 daughters gathered in Connecticut to hold a memorial service for their mother. A headstone was placed in the cemetery listing her birth and death dates, along with the message, loved and missed. It was a difficult time for the family of sisters who had lost so much over the previous 4 years. One daughter, who asked not to be named, commented that after all this time, she thought the police would have solved the case. But after everything, they hadn't come up with anything. Gary McQuestion had similar feelings, though being a lawyer, his sights were set on the courtroom, as he told the Daily Herald, quote, "It amazes me that nobody has held an inquest in this case long before now. It would get some people under oath in front of a judge, having to answer some difficult questions." End quote. The Vermont State Police did not offer a response, saying only that the case was open and being investigated. 4 long years would pass before police announced a major search was finally going to happen. On October 19, 2001, the State Department of Environmental Conservation sent a notice to the Washington Electrical Cooperative, the power company which controls Wrightsville Dam, notifying them to begin drawing down the water in the reservoir. It was a slow process, lowering the water level by 1 foot per day. But in early November, the water had gotten low enough for police to come in and conduct a large search with cadaver dogs. That search took place between November 14th and 15th, granting access to all areas that had previously been submerged with low or no visibility. According to police, they had wanted to do this much earlier, but their requests had been rejected on several occasions, noting possible damage to the dam, the downstream area, wildlife in the area, and the power structure of the region which depends upon the dam. Unfortunately, though, after all that time and finally getting to do the search they wanted, no trace of Audrey was found. 5 years later, on August 21st, 2006, 13 years to the day since Audrey vanished, her daughters tried to thrust her story back into the spotlight by holding a service at the very park and ride parking lot where her truck was found. A white cross emblazoned with flower stencils was erected at the site, with her children writing their own messages on the back. Audrey's oldest daughter, Angela, in her 30s at this point, discussed how hard it is to deal with loss when you don't know what happened, when you have no answers. She stated, quote, "When this happens to you, there's no moving forward. We haven't even gotten to the place where we can go through the grieving process. Emotionally, we're at a standstill." End quote. Behind her, the white cross stood in stark contrast to the green of the trees. A message written on the surface read in part, "I looked for you today, just like yesterday, as I will tomorrow." Sergeant Mike Henry of the Vermont State Police, who had recently taken over the case, was present at the service and hoped it might cause someone to come forward with information. He noted that more than 20 different investigators had interviewed multiple people of interest over the years, and that the case was still being looked at closely. 3 years later, in April of 2009, the Vermont State Police, in conjunction with the Montpelier Police and members of the New England Canine Search Team, arrived at a parcel of land that had previously been bypassed. While the wooded area behind the park and ride had been searched, there was a large wooded area half a mile to the east, just across Memorial Drive, that hadn't. Investigators received a tip about this location in November of 2008, but had chosen to wait for the ice and snow to thaw before looking. 6 dogs and 10 searchers worked the area for several hours, but as has always been the result, nothing connected to Audrey was found. When asked about the search and Audrey's disappearance now 16 years later, Captain Edward Leto, the chief criminal investigator for the Vermont State Police, explained that the answers were out there, that there were people who knew the truth. Captain Leto stated, quote, "There's somebody out there who knows something, and for whatever reason, they haven't come forward. We are hoping that they will." End quote. Sadly, 12 more years have passed, and it appears the truth of Audrey's fate remains as elusive as it was 28 years ago, in August of 1993. When last seen, Audrey Gale Grote was described as being a white female with dyed strawberry blonde hair and blue eyes, standing 5 feet 6 inches tall and weighing approximately 120 pounds. There is no description available for what she was wearing at the time, nor what jewelry she may have had. However, it is noted that she has a scar on her right knee. Audrey was last seen in Northfield, Vermont, on Saturday, August 21, 1993, at approximately 2 p.m. in the company of Patrick Jarvis. She was in his beige two-door Ford Escort and had a red and silver Chevy S10 truck, which was found parked at the park and ride on Dog River Road in Montpelier the following day, Sunday, August 22nd. Audrey Grote had a rough go of things, but she spared little time to complain, instead choosing to focus on trying to do what she could to provide a better life for her 6 children. She worked hard to build a future for her kids, to build a home with them, and then one day, she never came back. At the time, she had children ranging in age from 11 to 21. This August will mark 28 years since she vanished. She never got to see her daughters marry, have their own children, graduate high school, go off to college. She never got to give them the life she wanted, nor all the love she had to offer. In August of 1993, Audrey's youngest daughter was just 11. This year, she'll turn 40, 1 year younger than her mother was the last time she saw her. 28 years is a long time to wait for answers, to wonder what became of a woman who inspired you, raised you, loved you, and would have done anything for you. 6 children, scattered into different families in the aftermath of the most horrifying moment of their lives, still come together in remembrance of the mother who meant so much to them. It's their hope that someday they'll know the truth and see justice done, that one day they'll be able to bring their mother home and lay her to rest beneath the stone that bears her name. After all this time, there are reminders everywhere. They can see their mother in the faces of their children, hear her voice in the tones of their own voices, feel her in the absence of her embrace. The first Mother's Day after Audrey vanished was a difficult one, which, year after year, returns to remind them of their loss and of their pain. Tanya, Audrey's second eldest daughter, wrote a poem for her mother that first holiday spent without her, and her words ring as true today as they did 28 years ago. "We love you now, we'll love you forever, but we loved you most when we were together. So why did you go away? Because we'll love you now and forever. We'd like to give you flowers and write neat little poems, for Mother's Day is so special and you should be home. Our hearts are so empty, not just because we're not together, but because you're gone too. You made us feel safe and you made us feel warm. You are very much loved and appreciated. You are a treasure we could once hold, and now just a memory, and history will be told." Is there something standing in the way of your happiness? Something that keeps you from achieving your goals? I've been there more times than I'd like to admit. There's nothing wrong with admitting that you could use some help, and thankfully there's a great service available to you, BetterHelp. BetterHelp assesses your needs and provides you with your own licensed professional therapist. You can easily connect to a safe, secure, and private online environment to discuss the things that are weighing you down. BetterHelp is not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It's professional counseling done conveniently and securely online. You can message your counselor anytime and receive thoughtful responses. You can schedule weekly video or phone sessions right from the comfort of your own home. No uncomfortable waiting rooms. One thing I really love about BetterHelp is the affordability. It's less costly than traditional offline counseling, and they even offer financial aid. Find the help you need, not just what's offered by counselors close to home. BetterHelp provides licensed professional counselors who specialize in depression, stress, anxiety, relationships, sleeping, trauma, and so much more. Most importantly, with BetterHelp, everything you share is confidential, and counseling is offered securely and conveniently. So many people are using BetterHelp that they've been recruiting additional counselors across all 50 states. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/trace. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/trace. One day, everything seems to be going according to plan, and by the next morning, the entire world is turned upside down. That's how quickly it happens, how fast a see you later can become 28 years without a trace. When Audrey Grote walked out of her home that warm summer afternoon, no one could have imagined she'd never return, especially not her children. She'd always been there for them, the one constant in an ever-changing world, and then she was gone, and nothing would ever be the same. No one really knows exactly what was going on that August day. Was it supposed to be a shopping trip to the mall just an hour away, or an angry confrontation between a protective mother and the man who had done the unthinkable? The family has their thoughts, and investigators have their own. There's Jarvis's account of what happened that night, a story with more holes in it than the plot of a low-budget sci-fi drama. They have locations and travel times that could make sense, but don't really seem to. There are questions whose answers are surely out there somewhere, but they haven't yet been discovered. Vermont may be one of the smallest states in the country, but when you're searching for a 5-foot-6-inch-tall, 120-pound woman somewhere inside the more than 6 million acres of land dotted with ponds, lakes, and rivers, it becomes appallingly clear how easily someone can disappear. But this isn't like a lot of other missing persons cases. This isn't a situation where someone walked out the door and was gone without a trace, with no direction to turn and no inch of ground to begin on. We know where Audrey was that afternoon. We know who she was with that night. The problem lies in knowing that the last person to see her alive is either completely innocent, despite the perceived flaws in his story, or the one person who could hold all of the answers is also the one who most desperately wants them to remain hidden, never to be revealed. So it becomes a choice between someone with a convincing motive and a bizarre story, or a phantom, some mysterious figure driven by an unknown purpose who just happened to strike at a time and place where everyone would be looking the other direction. There's a lot of information out there about the last night Audrey was seen. The problem is, we have no way of knowing how much of it's actually true, and that adds a layer of complication that has led to her case going unsolved for almost 30 years. I can't say there's a ton of theories. It basically comes down to Patrick Jarvis, or someone who saw a lone woman at a park and ride late at night and decided to cash in on the opportunity. So rather than examining one point and then the other, I think it's best to tackle everything at once, to examine what we know happened and what we believe most likely happened. The last time anyone saw Audrey alive outside of Jarvis was when she dropped off her daughter at a friend's house in the Middlesex area. The home was apparently located along Shady Rill Road, just a 10-minute drive north of the park and ride where Audrey left her truck. There have been multiple accounts stating that Audrey arrived alongside Jarvis to make the drop-off, though there's also a few which say she arrived alone, and then proceeded on to the park and ride where Jarvis picked her up. I don't know that this is the most important detail, but it would be nice to know for sure, one way or the other. In regard to the truck, I've seen a lot of people getting caught up on why Audrey would leave her truck behind at the park and ride, and while I have no absolute answer for that, if she truly believed she was going to the mall, 45 minutes to an hour away, she probably wouldn't have wanted to drive her truck there. By all accounts, it wasn't in the best shape, and why risk breaking down when you don't have to? This doesn't seem like a vastly important detail, but I do think it gives us a look into Audrey's thought process that day. I find it hard to believe that if she knew about Jarvis's sexually assaulting the child and was planning to confront him, it's difficult to imagine she'd be willing to 1, travel anywhere with him, 2, willingly get into his car, and 3, not tell anyone in advance of what she was planning to do. Now, maybe it's possible she didn't imagine he could be capable of something like murder, and she figured confronting him wouldn't result in a massive fight, physical struggle, or any other situation that would lead to her coming to harm, but even so, it just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. At the same time, Audrey was a strong-willed, no-hold-back kind of person, and I could buy her believing she was planning to tear this guy apart, or maybe just see how he reacted to the accusation before going to the police. It's easy to look at this through the modern lens with hindsight on your side, but the truth is, having never lived inside Audrey's mind, I can't begin to imagine what her plan really was. Police believe she knew and was going to confront him. However, there still is this story about going shopping together, which would imply she didn't know. I suppose the only person who could really know for sure, outside of Jarvis, is the child that was victimized by that horrible person. And I'd imagine the police know for certain, one way or the other. So, there's a couple of different ways to look at it. Audrey goes to the mall with Jarvis and something happens afterwards. Or Audrey never intended to go to the mall with him and they were actually going somewhere else. Or Audrey did go to the mall, did get back to the park and ride, and something happened there after he left. Jarvis gave a pretty detailed account of where they went, what times everything occurred, and what he did afterwards. Now, obviously some of the story doesn't line up, and certain aspects of it changed in subsequent tellings, but he either thought this out in advance and was planning out his story, or he had to put everything together that night. If he had no idea that Audrey knew what he'd been doing, then he'd have no reason to plan anything. If he did have an idea, then he definitely could have made a plan to try and stop the truth from getting out. I suppose the question would be how he knew, and there's really only two ways I can see that happening. Either Audrey told him in advance that she wanted to talk to him about something serious, or his victim acknowledged at some point that she had told Audrey. You have to keep in mind, you're talking about a preteen child who has been severely traumatized by this guy who's obviously skilled at manipulating children, so getting information from her probably wouldn't have been an overwhelming challenge. I guess the real question is, if this is something that was planned out in advance, why the hell does the story make so little sense? Well, maybe things didn't go like they were supposed to, or maybe he thought no one would ever look at him suspiciously, or just maybe he's a moron who thinks he's smarter than he is. So, let's look at the timeline and travel according to his varied accounts. First things first, they drive from Northfield to South Burlington to shop at the University Mall. Taking Interstate 89 with minimal traffic, that's approximately 37 miles in a 40-minute trip. Assuming they headed there straight from dropping off the daughter, that puts them at the mall sometime between 3 and 3:30. On a Saturday night in 1993, there's no way that mall wouldn't have been busy as hell. This was still the heyday of malls carrying over from their peak in the 80s. Yet, somehow, not one person has ever been found who could confirm seeing Audrey at the mall that day. No store clerk, janitor, security guard, or patron. Not entirely impossible. With that many people, it might be hard to keep track of someone who doesn't necessarily stand out, but maybe a little improbable. Unfortunately, it doesn't appear that there were any security cameras in place, no footage to check, and if Audrey did buy something, she must have done it with cash since there were no credit charges to track. Also, there's never been any report of purchases from the mall being found in her truck or anywhere else. One issue I have with the mall story, an issue that's been bothering me since the first time I read about Audrey's case, is why the hell she was going there in the first place. She was unemployed at the time and receiving welfare payments that she really resented having to take. She had clothes for her girls on layaway that she was slowly paying off because the new school year was coming. Does it make sense to anyone that she'd randomly decide to go shopping at a mall under those circumstances? It's never made much sense to me, but I also grew up in a family where we didn't have the best financial situation, and sometimes we'd go out to the mall just to walk around and do something. We weren't there to shop. We didn't have the money to buy random stuff. But we still wanted to spend Saturday morning doing something other than sitting on the couch. I've also entertained the idea that maybe the mall was cover for something else. Like, maybe they were planning to go to the reservoir and swim or boating for a bit, and Audrey just needed an afternoon of peace and quiet. So she said she was going to the mall instead. You know, as I was writing that, I thought to myself, how the hell is the mall a good cover? If you wanted to go somewhere and you didn't want to take the kids so you could just get a little break, there's probably far more boring places to say you're going rather than the mall. If I was 12 or 13 and my mother told me she was going to the mall, yeah, I'd want to go, even if just to look at all the cool stuff I couldn't get. Imagining they do actually go to the mall, how long does a trip like that take? If it's actually about shopping, then maybe an hour or two. If it's more about getting away for a while, then 3-4 hours, just hanging out. Obviously, we can't factor in things like how many stores there were, what places each person would want to look in, what type of shopper each person was. So to be safe, let's put it at 3 hours. That has them leaving the mall sometime between 6 and 6:30 p.m. Now, according to Jarvis, after the mall, they went to a Wendy's, where he ordered chili with cheese and extra crackers. I don't know if police asked him what Audrey ordered, but I'd be curious if it lined up with what she would normally get. Anyway, figure that takes 10 to 15 minutes since it's hard to drive and eat chili with crackers, so I'm assuming they'd have eaten in the parking lot or gone inside. Also, maybe it's just me, but they were just at a big mall. Didn't they have a food court there? I don't know, maybe he really wanted Wendy's and they didn't have one. Either way, tack on 15 minutes, and now we're looking at 6:15 to 6:45. Then they begin the drive back to Montpelier, another 40 or so minute drive, making them get back to town somewhere between 6:55 and 7:25. Jarvis says he went to a grocery store in the area to buy beer and cigarettes, so let's tack on another 15 minutes for travel and purchasing. Now we're between 7:10 and 7:40. From the store, they drive over to the tent that he set up somewhere along Baldock Road, most specifically near the upper end of Terrace Street, which from Montpelier proper is around 8 to 10 minutes, bringing us to between 7:18 and 7:50. Jarvis claims that splitting a 12-pack of beer, they each drink 6, then have sex. Assuming they don't just down the beers like they're at a frat party, it should take somewhere between 20 and 30 minutes to finish that first beer. I'll be generous here and say that the subsequent beers go down faster as the buzz kicks in, and we'll clock it in at a lightning speed of an additional 15 minutes per beer, which is still remarkably fast for a woman who doesn't really drink. So 20 minutes for the first, then 15 for each after, which would be an hour and 15 minutes just for the last 5. So all in all, just drinking the 6 beers is, on the very low end, an hour and 35 minutes. Now we're looking at between 8:53 and 9:25. I'm not feeling all that generous in the sex department, so I've turned to researchers on that, and several studies have found the average length of time when studying multiple couples is approximately 4.8 to 5.8 minutes, so let's give him 5. 8:58 to 9:30. Frankly, I'm surprised he could even keep it up with all that alcohol in him and the fact that Audrey wasn't, you know, a preteen child. The drive back from the campsite to the park and go is 5 miles or 10 minutes, making him arrive between 9:08 and 9:40 p.m. Also, keep in mind if you will, Audrey told her daughter she'd be home by 6:30, and she was known to call if she was going to be late, but at no time during the 3.5 to 4 hours after 6:30 passes does she attempt to make a single call home. Kind of weird, isn't it? Despite some highly questionable numbers regarding how long it would take to drink 6 beers, that fits his timeline as he claims to have dropped Audrey off between 9:30 and 10. Of course, we do have to factor in 2 other details. Firstly, drinking 6 beers in less than 2 hours is quite a bit. According to Jarvis's record, he was clocked in at standing 5 feet 10 inches tall and weighing 155 pounds. So I rounded up to 160. 6 beers consumed in 2 hours would have registered a blood alcohol content level of 0.16. In Vermont, 0.08 is the legal limit, putting Jarvis at twice that amount. At this level, it's reported that he likely would have experienced impaired reflexes, judgment, and possibly nausea. Also, according to the American Addiction Center's report, this level also has a high probability of impairing sexual function. Now, turning to Audrey herself, being 5 feet 6 inches tall and weighing 120 pounds, her blood alcohol content would come in at 0.27. According to the documentation, this would result in a massive loss of motor control, a high likelihood of vomiting, and/or passing out. At this level, it's advised that a person seek emergency medical care. Now, don't forget, within 30 minutes, they're going to be back at the park and go, where, according to Jarvis, Audrey walks to her truck, gets inside, and starts the engine. There's no report of her stumbling, being sick, or showing any effects of the large amount of alcohol she's just consumed. Even if we change things around and say, hell, let's give Jarvis the benefit of the doubt. Let's calculate their levels assuming they didn't go to the park and go until 4 hours after they had their first beer. That leaves Audrey still at a 0.24 and Jarvis at a 0.13, above the legal limit and experiencing blurred vision, slurred speech, and it's advised that someone at this level not operate a vehicle. Keep in mind, after dropping off Audrey, Jarvis claims to have driven back to his apartment, a 9-mile trip, taken a shower, changed his clothes, and then made the 46-mile or 52-minute drive back to Burlington. We know he was seen in his apartment between 10 and 10:30 because a witness spotted him there. This means even if we err on the side of leniency and surmise that he drank his first beer at, say, 4 p.m., 7 hours before 11 p.m., he's still legally impaired if pulled over and would be arrested. Following the timeline we've already mapped out, with the first drink occurring between 7:18 and 7:50, by 11 p.m., an hour after he claims to have left Audrey, he would still be at a 0.14. However, he alleges to have driven back to Burlington 46 miles, where he cruises around for an unknown distance, and then heads north to the Milton area 15 miles, where he, for some reason, decided to go fishing until after sunrise, which occurred at 6.05 a.m. So, at a 0.14, he drives somewhere around 60 miles. Not a cop on the road sees him driving while impaired. No other drivers call in to report a drunk driver. He doesn't have an accident or scrape up his car, and he still has the wherewithal to cast a line and hang out until past sunrise, at which time he has to make the 60-mile drive home, having been awake for at least 16 hours, assuming he woke up only 5 minutes before meeting with Audrey. Yet, that same day, he still has time to pick up one of Audrey's daughters, take her to the Baldock Road campsite, where he allegedly collects a shovel before taking her back to his apartment. Is all of that entirely possible? Sure, physically someone could pull it off. But we're kind of getting into the area bordering on miracles. You know, like how sometimes someone falls from a great height or is involved in a really bad car accident but comes out of it without a scratch. Possible, yes, but incredibly improbable. Now, let's for a moment follow this story as though it were true. In one discussion, Jarvis says he saw Audrey get into her truck and start the engine before he drove off. In another, he says he returned 30 minutes later and saw Audrey still just sitting in the truck. Considering the amount of alcohol she just drank, the only way I'd believe that is if she had succumbed to the alcohol and lost consciousness while sitting up. However, the question stands, why would he come back 30 minutes later? If everything was fine when he left the first time, he has no reason to check. Nor would most people think the friend who got in and started their truck would still be sitting there 30 minutes later. Maybe it's to pad the timeline, buy an extra 30 minutes, or maybe he did return to the park and go that night, but maybe not to check on Audrey. Her purse was found there in the bushes, her keys were locked in the truck. Say a car drove by, and on the off chance he was seen there after 10 p.m., there would have to be a reason why. Or maybe, as most of you are thinking, not a thing about this makes any damn sense. I literally feel like I asked a 6-year-old where he was and now I'm trying to analyze the details of his babble. For at least the time between 2:30 p.m. and when Jarvis is spotted at his apartment between 10 and 10:30, there's a 7.5 to 8 hour space of time which has never been adequately explained. Driving 60 miles per hour in that time, a driver could span more than 400 miles. So making a radius of 200 miles with the park and ride at the center, he could have traveled as far as Quebec City to the north, Bangor, Maine to the east, Kingston, Ontario, or Syracuse, New York to the west, or New Haven, Connecticut to the south. Also, and maybe this is just me, but if you have an apartment where you have no qualms about bringing a preteen child over to sexually assault her, why in the hell are you putting up tents in the woods to allegedly have sex with a 41-year-old woman? Most of the time when people put together a story to explain where they were and what they were doing, and they don't want you to know the actual truth, they're going to go one of two ways. They're either going to select random locations and try to make it sound like a regular day, or they're going to try to be smart enough to realize someone could have seen them or their vehicle in or near places they actually did go. So they'll name those places, ensuring that any witness accounts police get actually corroborate their story. This is why police search the river up in Milton, search the woods around the campsite, search the woods near the park and go. They spent a lot of time focusing on the Wrightsville Dam and Reservoir, both of which are just two turns from Baldock Road and less than 4 miles from the campsite. Jarvis gave a fairly detailed account, but oftentimes people trying to conceal the truth commit themselves to too much detail. When you're telling your friend about your day, do you give them every single detail, the entire blow-by-blow, or just the gist of the story? Perhaps that's why there's a story about fishing here. To explain if someone saw him near a body of water, or if wet and muddy clothes were found in his apartment or vehicle. Speculation on my part entirely, but not out of the realm of possibility. I can't help but also have my attention drawn to Lake Champlain, which is 107 miles long, 14 miles wide, has an average depth of 64 feet and a max depth of 400 feet, and it's within 10 miles of Milton. The river access location Jarvis is reported to have said he went to that night is literally less than half a mile from the lake. This location is also right off Route 2, which, if followed northwest for another 3 miles, crosses the lake. There aren't any tall fences or boundaries along the side, just a small guardrail. And there's even a small parking area where you can pull over and there's no guardrail there at all. You can just walk down the embankment to the water. So where would you choose to dump a body? A river, which can be searched and dragged, and that you told police about. A reservoir, which can be searched and drained, which you mentioned to police. Or a massive lake that would be nearly impossible to search. Of course, I do get caught up on the account of Jarvis picking up a shovel from the campsite the next day. A search was done in that area, and as far as we know, there was no reports of freshly turned earth discovered, nor did cadaver dogs pick up the scent of decomposition. However, within a 15-mile radius of that location, in addition to the Wrightsville Reservoir, you have the Waterbury Reservoir, C.C. Putnam State Forest, and a handful of different small lakes and ponds. To say you're looking for a needle in a haystack, I don't think is adequate to truly express how many different locations could have been used, and sadly, there's not really a way to search all of them. Not without hundreds of people and years of free time. It's real hard to look in another direction when you take the time to break everything down here. You have the option of a guy with a pretty clear motive, to avoid being arrested for sexually assaulting a child, who has both the means and the opportunity. As an experienced hunter in the area, according to several problems he's run into with the Fish and Wildlife Agency, Jarvis would also be well equipped to know areas where remains could be left that are going to put them at a high likelihood of being tampered with, destroyed, or dragged away by animals. While Vermont has no record of wolves being native to the state, coyotes certainly are. And while they're reported as being in several areas all across the state, one in which they're noted as being found is in the Champlain Valley. While attacks on humans are rare, they will eat human remains if they find them. With all of that being said, Is it possible that Audrey was in fact dropped off alive at the park and go and something happened to her there? Yes. Depending on which of his accounts you believe, she was either alive and well at 10 or alive and well 30 minutes later at 10:30. Just sitting in her truck 15 minutes from home, you know, as you often do when you're running 4 hours late and your daughters are going to be worried, why rush? She could have encountered an abductor there. She could have accidentally locked her keys in the truck and hitched a ride with someone who had ill intentions. There's a myriad of possibilities. The problem, ultimately, becomes the utter absence of evidence of anyone seeing her alive after 2:30 p.m. Not one person. Not at the mall, Wendy's, the grocery store, the park and go, the campsite. No one, nowhere. That doesn't necessarily rule out the possibility of someone else being involved, but it surely doesn't make it the most likely either. I don't know what the odds would be of Audrey falling victim to a random attacker on this particular night following the utterly illogical story as told by Jarvis, but it's got to be tantamount to getting struck by lightning at the same moment you win the lottery. It also doesn't help that years later, when placed on the stand and questioned about this night, the only answer he would supply was that he was pleading the fifth to avoid self-incrimination. If your story's true, if what you've said is exactly what happened and you didn't do anything wrong, what crime exactly are you trying to avoid admitting to? When you look at everything, break it down, cut through the rumors, myths, and lies, and get down to what you actually know, what can be proven, all you've got is Audrey went off with Jarvis and was never seen again. There's some wiggle room there, and while I understand the family's frustration, I also understand why charges were never filed. There's not quite enough to completely dispel reasonable doubt, at least not in the legal sense. Why risk a loss and the blockade of double jeopardy if all you really need is that one piece to make it all come together? Now, it's been 28 years. And that piece hasn't yet been found. I imagine that has to drive both investigators and Audrey's families crazy. And I don't blame them for one second, because it drives me crazy. I'm a big believer in the likelihood that eventually everything comes out. Over the nearly 3 decades that have passed, what are the chances someone hasn't been told this story? A close friend, relative, former or current girlfriend, even if done so in just a threatening way. 3 decades gives someone a lot of time to let the secret out, and friendships and relationships can turn from close and caring to distant and angry at a moment's notice. Surely, someone out there knows the truth. Why they haven't come forward yet, as in all cases I've covered, is the one mystery I don't think we'll ever solve. I mean, who the hell would lie, stonewall, and go out of their way to defend someone who on 2 separate occasions has pled guilty in court to lewd and lascivious acts with minors? Sick people with no conscience is the only answer I've got. 28 years ago, 41-year-old Audrey Grote left with a family friend and never came home. In her absence, her 6 daughters have had to go forward with their lives while being haunted by the unanswered questions about her fate. All these years later, only 1 daughter remains who has yet to pass the age her mother was when she disappeared. Finding the truth won't bring her back. It won't alleviate all of that pain or erase the horrible memories of that terrible day, but it might just give them a chance to come to terms with what happened, to see their mother laid to rest, and to try and find some sense of acceptance in seeing justice delivered. Unfortunately, unless Audrey is found, someone confesses, new evidence is discovered, or someone comes forward to tell what they know, the disappearance of Audrey Grote will remain open, unsolved, and very cold. If you're looking for more information about the disappearance of Audrey Grote, there's honestly not a ton of it out there. However, the Rutland Daily Herald and the Burlington Free Press did extensive coverage of this case at the time, and without their work, this episode would not have been possible. If you have any information about the disappearance of Audrey Grote, please contact the Vermont State Police at 802-244-8727. You can also submit tips anonymously on their website at vsp.vermont.gov/tip-submit. You can text the word VTIPS to the number 274-637, or you can email Lieutenant John McCallum at john.mccallum@vermont.gov. That's McCallum, McCallum. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. Trace Evidence would not be possible without support from amazing listeners like you. And now I'd like to take a moment to thank our fantastic Patreon producers: Alicia Lorraine, Brittany Bivens, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Denise Dingsdale, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, James, Jennifer Winkler, Joni Berkowitz, Kara Moreland, Kevin Bonham, Marla Wright, Melissa Breckeisen, Michael Draves, Nick Mohar Schurz, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah Levinen, Sarah Mascaritolo, Travis Skepko, Stephanie Joyner, Stephanie Eve, Tom Archer, Tom Radford, Tracy Woods, and Vox Nihili. Your contributions to Trace Evidence are invaluable, and your support of the show is both appreciated and extremely humbling. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence and gaining access to exclusive merch and ad-free episodes, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or go to trace-evidence.com and click on the support option. That's going to conclude this week's episode. Thank you so much for listening, sharing the show, and helping keep these cases alive. I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.